It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about Native American and white communities joining together on environmental issues in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Our guest is the author of the new book, Unlikely Alliances. First, Senate Republican leadership says it has enough votes to pass the $1.5 trillion tax overhaul legislation. There is disagreement over who the tax plan would ultimately benefit or hurt in the long term. While there are still a lot of details to be worked out, it looks like the bill could have a huge impact on health care in the United States, with potential changes to the Affordable Care Act and possible cuts to Medicare. Julie Rovner joins us now. She's the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we get to health care, we're going to refer to the Senate tax overhaul plan. That only sort of exists, right? They're rewriting it as we speak.
That is correct. They are rewriting it. We've seen lists of potential amendments that will be changed. We just, in the last few minutes, saw a statement from Susan Collins, a Republican of Maine, one of the last holdout votes, about some of the changes that she managed to get into this bill in exchange for her agreement to vote for it. But, you know, it's important to remember that even if this bill passes the Senate, which now seems likely, although might not be till tomorrow, it still has to go to conference with the House. The House bill is very different. That could take a while. It could be difficult for them to come to an agreement on a single bill that both the House and Senate could pass.
So everything we say here is subject to change. But as you wrote in a piece that came out today, a lot of health care in this tax overhaul plan. Let's start with the individual mandate that is still, as I understand it, in the Senate plan to get rid of the Affordable Health Care Act individual mandate.
That's right. It's actually, because of the budget rules, they can't get rid of the mandate itself, but what they've done is they've reduced the potential fines to zero. So they've effectively gotten rid of the mandate by saying if you don't have health insurance, you won't have to pay any penalty, or the penalty you would have to pay is zero. There is a lot of concern in the health policy community about this and the impact that it could have on the individual market, people who buy their own insurance. Insurers, you know, that was their deal at the very beginning of creating the Affordable Care Act, that said, if you're going to make us take sick people, you're going to have to give us a way to get more healthy people into this pool. And the way to do that was to have this this fine for people who didn't have health insurance. Without the fine, there's a concern that healthy people will simply not buy insurance, and sick people will, because now they can, and that it's going to be prohibitively expensive for insurers. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that simply the repeal of this requirement would raise premiums by 10% per year, more than they would already go up, and 13 million fewer people would have insurance at the end of 10 years, some of them because they don't want to buy it and wouldn't have to pay a penalty, but some of them because they were simply priced out of coverage.
These issues you're talking about are part of why Republicans didn't end up passing a health care repeal law earlier this year. Why did this end up in the Senate tax overhaul package?
Well, frankly, because they needed the money. Repealing the requirement produces about $338 billion in savings. Some of that is from fines that people otherwise would have paid, but some of that also is from money that now the federal government won't have to pay to help people pay for their premiums, those premium subsidies. If people don't buy insurance, then the federal government won't have to help them buy it. That's where a lot of that savings comes from, and the Senate needed basically that money to pay for other things in the tax bill. Also, the individual mandate has by far been the most unpopular part of the Affordable Care Act, although, you know, if they were, you know, doing what sort of health policy analysts would suggest, they would have to repeal not just the individual mandate, but also the requirement for insurers to sell insurance to sick people.
We're talking to Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News, looking at the Senate tax overhaul plan and what congressional action could do when it comes to health care. The individual mandate wasn't the only thing you drew attention to, Julie. There's also Medicare. I want to listen to Senator Marco Rubio talking to Politico reporters earlier this week about the deficit and how this could all affect Social Security and Medicare.
The driver of our debt is the structure of Social Security and Medicare for future beneficiaries. We still have time, not just to save those programs, but responsibly structure them in a way that doesn't impact current retirees or people about to retire, but in a way that would probably impact it for me and people younger than me in ways that, quite frankly, you wouldn't really notice and you wouldn't really object to.
As I understand it, Julie, this Senate tax plan doesn't say, hey, we're cutting Medicare, but the impact might be to cut Medicare down the road. Is that right?
That's exactly correct, and it wouldn't be that far down the road. It would be next year. There's a separate law called PAYGO that basically says that if Congress adds more to the deficit and doesn't pay for it, that other programs, other spending would have to be cut. Social Security and Medicaid are not part of that, but Medicare is, and basically it would require effectively a cut of about 4% to Medicare. I think it's about $25 billion a year over 10 years. That's something that would happen automatically unless Congress then voted to waive it. Susan Collins, in saying that, you know, she's going to vote for this bill, said that she's been assured by Senator McConnell and Speaker Ryan that they won't let these cuts take effect, but they don't have control over 60 votes in the Senate. They would need Democrats to do that. It's quite the risk here for Republicans who say they don't want to cut Medicare, but they are willing to add $1.5 trillion to the deficit.
There's a lot of deal making here going on, and at least the deal you just pointed out may not be enforceable. This might not be something they can back up down the road. Does that apply to a lot of these issues we're talking about?
It does. I mean, you know, we saw Senator Flake of Arizona said that he would vote for this bill because he's been promised that Congress will do something subsequently on the Dreamers, the children who were brought to this country illegally by their parents. It's not at all clear that will happen. There have been a number of sort of things that have been promised that the promisers can't necessarily follow up on.
A couple other issues you point toward: a repeal or a change to the medical expense deduction. What's happening?
That's right. This is in the House bill and not in the Senate bill, but the House bill would eliminate a number of popular deductions, and one of these is the medical expense deduction, which was changed in the Affordable Care Act. So really only if you have very, very high medical expenses, more than 10% of your adjusted gross income, you can take this deduction. So as a result, not that many people do. It's about 9 million people, but the people who do take it have extremely high expenses. It's mostly for long-term care expenses, for families with disabled children, or for people with chronic diseases who have very expensive treatments for those diseases. And the Republicans said, well, you know, we're going to double the standard deduction, so that will make up for it. But doubling the standard deduction isn't going to begin to make up for these people who are spending $60,000 and $70,000 and $80,000 a year on their health care.
Another change that may be on the way: taxes on tuition waivers for graduate students, which doesn't sound like a health issue right away, but I guess graduate students includes medical students.
That's right. Well, actually, the tuition waivers are mostly for science, people pursuing PhDs in science, and obviously PhDs in anything, but there's a concern about the research pipeline. The way it works now is if you go to a university as a graduate student, they waive the tuition, you get a small stipend for teaching, and you don't have to pay taxes on the tuition that you're not paying. This would say that you would have to pay taxes on the value of that tuition, even though you're not paying it. Now, the other thing that really would affect young doctors is the elimination of the deduction for student loan debt, because 75% of medical students who graduated in 2017 had student loan debt. Half of them owe nearly $200,000. Again, when they first graduate, they're not paid very much. So that would be a significant increase to the taxes that they would owe also.
And finally, a repeal of incentives for drug companies to treat rare diseases. Is that right?
That's right. This is the Orphan Drug Act that was passed in the 1980s that encouraged drug makers to develop and market drugs for rare diseases or for diseases that affect fewer than 200,000 people. And part of that is a tax credit. The House would eliminate that tax credit. The Senate would not eliminate it but scale it back. There's concern that the tax credit has been abused by some drug makers using it for drugs that are not necessarily orphan drugs. But at the same time, this credit has been used to bring drugs that serve only specialized drugs for specialized populations of people. So groups that represent people who have these rare diseases are very upset about getting rid of this drug credit.
Julie, as we said up front, these are all subject to change. But as we wrap up, are these health issues being kind of swept under the rug as part of this massive tax overhaul package?
Well, some of them are and some of them aren't. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about the individual mandate and the potential impact of that on people who buy their own insurance. I think the people are starting to pay attention to some of the potential Medicare cuts. I think the rest of them, you know, there are so many things in this tax bill. It's a very big bill. And again, it does change, you know, from hour to hour. The anticipation at this point is the Senate will pass it and that it will go to conference with the House. And I think maybe more attention will be paid there.
Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime.
Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She joined us today to talk about the Senate tax plan and what impact it could have on health care policy. Right now, the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota last year found support across tribal and racial lines. And this year, the Keystone XL pipeline being revived by the Trump administration is being opposed by a group called the Cowboy Indian Alliance. Those are some of the latest examples of Native communities and white Americans finding common ground on environmental issues. Our next guest says that if those alliances share a sense of purpose and respect cultural differences, they can lead to real change. Zoltan Grossman is a professor of geography and Native studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. He's the author of the new book, Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Joined to Defend Rural Lands. He's a graduate of UW-Madison, previously taught at UW-Eau Claire. Zoltan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's a long history, of course, of conflict between white Americans and Native Americans. You found significant moments of cooperation. What's given rise to some of these alliances around environmental issues over the last four decades or so?
Well, since the 1970s, starting in the Northwest, the Northern Plains, then into the Great Lakes, we've seen this pattern that some of the areas that went through some of the most intense conflicts over treaty rights, such as the spearfishing conflict in northern Wisconsin, ended up seeing some of the earliest and strongest alliances to protect the same natural resources that tribes and their rural white neighbors, such as farmers, ranchers, fishers, were fighting over. And I was involved in some of the work against metallic sulfide mines in northern Wisconsin. I was just fascinated by this and seeing some of the same patterns in places like South Dakota and Montana and here in Washington State. And it's really encouraging that oftentimes we hear that identity politics or cultural identity is somehow counterposed or in contradiction to unity politics of bringing people together. But what I found both through firsthand experience and also through interviewing about 120 people is that they're not in contradiction and that Native rights, treaty rights, can in fact be protecting the environment and local rural economies, benefiting everyone, including their rural white neighbors.
I want to talk about that spearfishing story a little more. It was a huge thing, of course, here in Wisconsin, very heated, I think overtly racist protests in some cases against targeting Native Americans, Ojibwe residents of the area over fishing rights. But you write that some of the people on the opposite sides of that treaty rights debate, as you were just saying, became allies. How did they move from a really bitter confrontation into cooperation?
Well, keeping dialogue open and keeping a bridge open, some of the spearfishing treaty rights leaders, such as Walt Brissett, such as Tom Molson, actually were interested in building bridges to some of their rural white neighbors, even in the midst of the conflict. Walt Brissett from Red Cliff said that he felt he had more in common with the anti-Indian people than with the state of Wisconsin that was not protecting the fish. And so many of the followers of some of the anti-treaty organizations began realizing once mining companies started coming into the ceded territory of northern Wisconsin, that in fact the anti-treaty movement wasn't going to protect them, and they, in fact, that the treaties that they had been fighting were some of the most important tools to protect the fishery and the local tourism economy. And I found what was fascinating is some of the areas of the most intense conflict around spearfishing, around Lac du Flambeau, Mole Lake, it was easier to form an environmental alliance and was more successful than around Lac-Qui-Dor, where the conflict was not as intense and where the Ladysmith mine ended up being built. So near Lac du Flambeau, the Lynn mine was prevented from being open, and of course near Mole Lake, the long struggle against the Crandon mine was successful in 2003.
It's interesting to think back to the debates in the 1980s You kind of point out that people realized over time that they'd had a shared value on both sides of the debate all the time, the value of conservation and the joys of fresh water and fishing.
Yeah, and when you have a local economy based partly on tourism, that means it's also an economic argument. And so if you want to protect your environment, instead of arguing over the fishery, you come together to protect the fishery against some of these foreign mining companies. So you had people, sportsmen like Herb Bittner, who was actually chairman of the Langley County Republican Party, who put anti-mining literature on the Republican Party table at the Langley County Fair. You had George Rock. You had union members like Jerry Gunderson, Bob Schmitz, Debbie McNutt. You had students like Dana Chernus, Deanna Erickson. So these companies love to divide people not only racially between Native and white, but also pitting environmentalists against labor unions, northern rural residents against urban students. And try as they might, they couldn't divide Wisconsinites by either race, class, or by region. And so you, across the country, you have this stereotype of the mainstream, urban-based, largely white environmental movement that they're just a bunch of hippies and yuppies who don't care about rural jobs. But what you had in Wisconsin in particular was the development of a new kind of environmental movement that was rural-based on the front lines of local people, middle-class, working-class people, multiracial, multigenerational, and the companies do not know how to defeat that kind of a movement anywhere in the country.
We're talking to Zoltan Grossman, author of the book Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Join to Defend Rural Lands. And I think when people think of Native protest and environmental issues, the big story over the last few years has involved pipelines in North Dakota and many other states for that matter. How do you apply the lessons you took from here in Wisconsin and elsewhere to what we're seeing in the news today?
Well, South Dakota historically was also, like northern Wisconsin, always a very heavy area of conflict between Native peoples, Lakota, and some of the white ranchers. But when there was coal and uranium mining proposed in the Black Hills, a bombing range, they've tended to come together in local areas. So this is not necessarily something completely new. But when the Keystone XL pipeline was proposed, these people came together in a very powerful way in South Dakota and Nebraska, and they're now coming together again against that pipeline. I think maybe the pipeline companies learned their lessons in North Dakota, which is really a petrostate that's so much more dependent on oil than any other state I looked at. And so they fast-tracked the Dakota Access Pipeline. They criminalized the opposition, militarized the situation, and put up roadblocks to pit some of the local white residents against the Native people. And so perhaps they're learning their lessons trying to reduce democracy so another cowboy Indian alliance couldn't develop. But now that the Keystone XL pipeline has been revived, the opposition is coming back together, and I think Trump faces an uphill struggle to get that pipeline through. In the Pacific Northwest, here in Washington and Oregon, there were 14 new oil and coal terminals proposed to bring the fossil fuels from the Bakken Basin in North Dakota or the Alberta Tar Sands Powder River Coal Basin to our coast to export abroad. And every single one of those proposals has been defeated now, just in the last week. The last ones fell by tribally led environmental opposition that includes some of the fishermen, some of the crabbers, some of the people who have previously been opposing tribal treaty rights in this region. So you see this pattern around the country, and it's been amazingly successful in many of these places.
And you write about a lot of examples at the very, very local level of cooperation between Native groups and white communities. Is that a pattern you just mentioned, is it emerging where they're cooperating between those communities around the country, so a local movement here is learning from a local movement there and visiting a third one over there?
Yeah, definitely. I think that each of the movements makes the next one easier to form. So the success around the Crandon mine, for instance, created a precedent for the people fighting the proposed iron mine in the Pinokis, and Bad River leading that opposition and scoring one of the only victories by a social movement, by an opposition movement against a proposal by Governor Walker. And so, again, we can see the strength of these rural movements that I think have been overestimated or underestimated as just kind of quaint rural local people that don't know much standing up to these giant companies. In fact, they're very much educated. They educate their neighbors. They organize their neighbors. They have potlucks. They have social interaction with each other and really build community in the process and learn about each other's cultures. So after they defeat a proposal or perhaps after they lose, they still have that greater cultural understanding of protecting sacred sites, protecting the wild rice, protecting the resources, and learning from each other. So it creates overall kind of a gradual improvement in relations and more neighborliness.
And as we wrap up, Zoltan, is there a lesson here for any group where there are two communities that, you know, maybe think they understand each other but really don't? How to bridge the gaps and start to break the ice between two groups?
Yeah, I think part of it is to find the people that already have some kind of contact between the groups. We've seen kind of looking to the future where they can cooperate over things like returning land, such as around the Kickapoo Dam or Badger Munitions, or protecting their water from the Perrier proposal or frac sand proposal that the Ho-Chunk Nation led. It's really to look to their common values over the land and what actually unites them, and oftentimes that is water. So that slogan at Standing Rock, water is life, is something that can really extend throughout the country, and that was certainly important in northern Wisconsin and southern Wisconsin.
Zoltan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Zoltan Grossman. He's a professor of geography and native studies at the Evergreen State College. He's the author of the book Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Joined to Defend Rural Lands. A lot of his case studies involve, as you just heard, stories from around Wisconsin. First, a lot of people turn to classic dishes this time of year, holiday staples that have been in the family for generations, maybe. But if you're looking to put a new spin on those classics, we've got some help for you now on this edition of Food Friday. Our guest says we can make great food and have fun doing it when we unleash the power of our creative side. Karen Page is the author of Kitchen Creativity, Unlocking Culinary Genius with Wisdom, Inspiration, and Ideas from the World's Most Creative Chefs. She's also the co-author of The Flavor Bible and What to Drink with What to Eat. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. Happy to be here.
So why is it important to unleash our creative side in the kitchen?
Well, because it's fun, first and foremost. You know, it's interesting. A couple of months ago, there was a study that was released that said that only 1 in 10 Americans actually enjoys cooking. And I found that to be incredibly sad because I think that it's one of those sensual pleasures that you can, that each of us can enjoy as many as 3 times a day. So I think this is the kind of book that we're hoping will actually help the other 9/10 of the country that doesn't like to cook.
And you write that, you know, cooking and food are one of the, obviously a key building block of our lives, and creativity is another one. So why not get them together?
Exactly. I mean, what better way to learn than from, I think, some of the most creative professionals in the world today, which are the world's most creative chefs. And that's exactly who we interviewed and profiled and photographed for Kitchen Creativity.
And you have kind of a three-step process. And the first thing to get creative is to be very uncreative, you write, and start copying and learning how people do the stuff they do as the first step to unleashing our own creativity. So where do we start?
Well, you know, it's something that Picasso has spoken of and written of, the fact that the secret to creativity is learning to what the rules are so that you can break them. And that's exactly what we focus on in Kitchen Creativity. The idea of mastery is where it all starts, acquiring the kind of knowledge, skill, and control that you need to be able to walk into a kitchen without a recipe and just open your refrigerator, open your cupboards, and be able to throw something together that's absolutely delicious and that's going to please your guests. And so in the first stage of Kitchen Creativity, we talk about how to really focus on thinking like a chef, shopping like a chef, and seasoning like a chef. And if you can do those three things, that will really give you the kind of mastery you need. We have a list of 20 of the cookbooks that the most creative chefs in the world recommend as basic reading material for anyone who's interested in cooking. If you read some or all, hopefully all, eventually, of these 20 books and have them available in your kitchen library, it will give you the basic building blocks you need whenever you're looking for more advice on what to do with an ingredient or what kind of technique you're looking to apply in your kitchen. And then beyond that, if you don't want to risk having a failure with your dish, you really want to invest in the kind of ingredients that the best chefs in America seek out. And so there's a list of dozens and dozens of companies all across the country, whether small artisanal producers or other mail order sources for ingredients that the best chefs have already given their stamp of approval to, and in many cases have recommended in their own cookbooks. You can order from them, you can have them shipped to wherever you are in the country, and work with the very best ingredients that that chefs work with themselves. And then learning to season is really just about how do you enhance the flavor of any ingredient you're working with. And it is often a matter of getting the right source of sodium or salt. It's getting the right acidity, whether that's a squeeze of lemon juice or a dash of just the right vinegar. And it is a matter of working to bring out the best, the essence of the ingredients that you're working with. So that'll get you in the ballpark in stage one.
Now, Karen, I'm really impatient. I want to start getting creative soon. And it looks like, I mean, anybody could spend years studying all these chefs. Can I just kind of narrow it down and pick, like, okay, this year I'm going to focus on, I don't know, Chinese cooking or baking or like one subset and start to learn those rules that way instead of learning all of the cooking?
Well, you know, I think there are different ways to learn about cooking, and the best chefs probably have, each of them has their own way that they've pursued. Traditionally in the United States, a lot of chefs have gone through a French-centric culinary education where they learn to make stocks, which is essentially a process of infusing the flavor of meat into sauces and then into various dishes. And of course, in 2017, we're much more health-focused. We understand the drawbacks of having too much animal protein in our diet and how that can correlate with heart disease and other illnesses. And so we're really pulling back in having a much more plant-forward diet. And part of that is really learning more principles of how do you create incredible flavor without over-relying on, say, meat stock or butter or cream, for example, and really getting some of the richness from other ingredients. So, for example, instead of some of the meat stocks, there is an emphasis on working with things like mushrooms and other umami-rich ingredients like miso. And I realize I am talking to a Midwesterner based in Wisconsin now. So when I'm talking about cream, it's a matter of minimizing, in some cases, not over-relying on cheese and dairy, and in some cases, adding richness to dishes through something like a pureed vegetable. Some of the best chefs use things like a pureed celery root or other vegetables that can add a sense of creaminess without over-relying on cream.
We grow plenty of mushrooms here, too, so you haven't offended Wisconsin.
Great mushrooms, in fact, yes.
We're talking to Karen Page. Her new book is Kitchen Creativity. Okay, so we've been learning from the best now, and step two is, and I love this portion of the book, alchemy, figuring out what works with what and what changes what. Can you talk about what you mean by alchemy in our cooking?
Absolutely. What we're really talking about here is just the idea of how do you take the common and convert it into the precious. And what we mean by that is taking an ingredient, maybe something as simple as a carrot, which we can take for granted if we see it raw on a plate of crudité. Well, a carrot can be something beautiful if you use the process of alchemy through combining it with just the right ingredients that pull out the flavors of carrots. For example, things like orange is so compatible with carrots that it really transforms it into a whole other flavor. It elevates it to a whole different level. Or through a technique like roasting that really adds a sense of caramelization to carrots so that you can really pull out the natural sweetness of the carrots, enhance the texture. And so the alchemy section of Kitchen Creativity is really about how do you unlock the secret of individual ingredients from A to Z. And that's something that we have written about previously in our books, The Flavor Bible, The Vegetarian Flavor Bible, and What to Drink with What You Eat. Whereas in What to Drink with What You Eat, we're really focusing on how do you use whatever is in the glass next to the plate you just created to enhance its flavor. So if you're serving something like back to those great mushrooms that you grow in Wisconsin, if you're serving that with a Gewürztraminer, it may not be the best possible wine pairing for a plate of mushrooms. But if you serve that with a Pinot Noir, there is a magic between the earthy, fruity flavors of a Pinot Noir with a plate of mushrooms. That's just going to be magical, and it's going to enhance any dish that you're serving. So once you understand the nuances in different ingredients and which herbs, spices, and other seasonings, as well as which beverages, will best enhance their flavor, you can really elevate your cooking to a whole new level.
And Karen, I think pretty much anyone who's ever cooked has had the moment where they taste what they're making and think, this needs something.
Exactly.
And the alchemy, I think, step of the equation here is going to help us figure out what that something is. And then, like, for example, this needs something acidic. And then you've got this chart with different types of acidic things and how sweet they are going along with it. So you start to grow that, use the force kind of to know what thing you need and what's the right way to get it.
That's exactly right. I'm so glad you caught that, because I think that's one of the strengths of the book, is a lot of people think, well, you know, acid, I've got this one cider vinegar that I use on everything. No. Vinegars are so complex and so wonderful. If you get just the right vinegar to match with just the right ingredient you're working with, sparks can fly. And it might be too much trouble for you to figure it out, but luckily the world's best chefs have figured out what is the right vinegar for certain ingredients. And that's the kind of information that we share in our books, The Flavor Bible, for example, that really get that specific so that you can grab just the right ingredient for whatever dish you're making. And in Kitchen Creativity, we talk about the difference it is in various vinegars. For example, sherry vinegar tends to be about 8% acidity, whereas something that's much softer, say a Swiss vinegar or a cane vinegar or even a malt vinegar, are just sort of 4 to 5% acidity. So it's a very different level of acidity, a very different level of flavor. So, you know, just if you want to play around in the kitchen, you can do something as simple as make a salad and make your vinaigrette with an oil and vinegar dressing and just switch up the vinegar that you add to it. And you can come up with your own preferred flavor profiles based on different vinegars that you substitute into the salad dressing. It's a lot of fun to develop your own palate that way to see what you like best.
We're talking to Karen Page now. Her new book is Kitchen Creativity, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get creative in the kitchen? If so, how? Do you take that recipe you've worked with and add a new twist to it? Are you able to go off the page and completely invent your own stuff? Or do you feel like you got to hit every note exactly as written in the recipe and you're timid about getting away from there? Karen might be able to talk you out of that a little bit. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Karen Page is with us for this week's edition of Food Friday. Her new book is Kitchen Creativity, Unlocking Culinary Genius with Wisdom, Inspiration, and Ideas from the World's Most Creative Chefs. You can call in with your questions or maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten creative in the kitchen, tried something completely different? Was it awesome? Was it a disaster? We'd love to hear about it. And do you need some suggestions for a new twist on an old favorite? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Okay, Karen, we've studied the chefs. We've learned about alchemy. Let's get creative now. And you have an exercise in the book that I love. Going back, thinking about your favorite foods as a kid and using those as inspiration. And you give the example in the book of you start with a caramel apple you used to love as a kid and come up with a whole bunch of dishes you could make that recreate that experience. Talk us through that.
Absolutely. Well, like you, Rob, I'm a Michigan native myself, and Michigan is known for having more apple cider mills per capita than any other state in the country. So no surprise that I fell in love with the first caramel apple I had at Yates Cider Mill outside Detroit. And it was a classic caramel apple with chopped nuts on it. So I found that as a kid, I loved that combination of apple and caramel and peanuts. And as an adult, I didn't stop loving that combination, but I did find, let's say, more adult ways of enjoying those flavors together. And for example, coming up with my own cocktail, I realized something that I loved was taking that apple cider, maybe mixing it with a little adult vodka, or skipping it if you want to make what they call a mocktail, without any alcohol at all. And it's just as delicious. You take a martini glass and you rim the edges in a little bit of melted caramel, and then you roll the edges of the martini glass in some crushed peanuts. And so you've got a cocktail that, as you hold it to your lips, you can chew the caramel and the peanuts and take a sip of that apple cider. And if you've added a little vodka, a little bit of that cocktail, and you can recreate all the flavors of childhood in a completely different, what we call, flavor platform. Same thing at dinner time. If you can take your typical green salad and you can slice some apples and throw it in your salad, switch out the croutons that you might typically use and throw in some peanuts instead. And then if you add a little bit of caramel to the vinaigrette you're making for the salad dressing, again, bingo. You've got those flavors. You know they work well together. You can use them in a savory setting as well. And I think, I don't know if you did the exercise yourself, Rob, but
I did not.
Okay. But anyone can just think about what was the favorite dish that you had growing up, and then take a minute to think about, well, what was the flavor combinations that made it work so well, that made you love it so much, and how might you be able to play with those combinations in a completely different way? And that's really what we've been doing as cooks for generations now, is taking classic combinations like the tomato, mozzarella, basil of Italy, or the soy sauce, garlic, and ginger of Asia, and playing around with them in different ways and applying them to different formats and coming up with entirely new dishes that you can have confidence are going to work well in your kitchen because they're based on these classic flavor chords.
We heard from Chris on Facebook. Chris says, okay, one of my favorite salads on a bed of watercress, mix the seeds from a pomegranate with clementine slices and fresh thyme, make a vinaigrette with orange juice, walnut oil, and sherry vinegar, and good for you and great with lamb. And that's a way that I do not get creative myself very much, Karen, is bringing fruit into savory dishes. It's just off my radar. You mentioned the oranges with the carrots earlier. Is that a good space for improvising?
Yeah, I think with fruit, the thing to think about is that it's not just fruit, it is texture, it is taste. In some cases, there is acidity as well as the sweetness. And so when things are a little too sweet, you want to make sure that you're balancing those flavors. And we talk a bit about flavor balance in the alchemy section, because as we learned through classic cuisines like Thai cuisine, that it is really about the balancing of all the basic tastes, the sweet, the sour, the salty, the bitter, and the umami that we get from a lot of Asian cuisines and through ingredients like Parmesan cheese and other intensely rich flavors. So if you can think about what you're looking to balance in a dish. If a dish is a little too salty, for example, or too earthy, fruit is often an accent that you can add a bit of balance to balance out something else.
Well, that's interesting, because when I hear complaints about beets, which I love and no one else in my family does, it's the whole taste like dirt thing. Mm. But fruit, you mentioned fruits can balance out the earthiness. I see fruit in beet-type salads from time to time.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely the case. And I think for exactly that reason. I think some palates are sensitive to the earthiness of beets. And often you'll see beets that are served with a white cheese of some kind, whether it's you know, a white cheese or in some cases a sour cream. And then that is often balanced with a nut of some kind, which adds a crunch, which is a different texture to it. And in some cases, there's a saltiness involved in the nut as well. So you'll see that beet, white cheese, nut combination very often as well.
We're talking to Karen Page. Her book, her new book, one of many, is Kitchen Creativity. She's helping us unlock our creative sides in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. My fear, Karen, is that I think back to my early days of cooking where I would just try to make whatever pie, pierogies, whatever I thought of without a recipe, just guessing, and it was inedible disasters a lot of the time. I'm better than that now, but I'm worried about I'm just going to break it. I'm going to ruin it. Talk me out of that fear.
Well, we quote, and I understand you're a musician as well, and we quote Miles Davis in the book and the fact that there are no such things as mistakes. And it's really important for people to think about cooking, I think in some cases like jazz, where you can just improvise. And maybe you're not creating what you intended to create, but maybe there's something that's still wonderful that can come out of your experimentation and to feel that sense of playfulness. So, for example, there's a great example in San Francisco of a bakery called Craftsman and Wolves, where the chef had asked an intern to hard-boil some eggs that he was going to put inside a muffin. Well, the inexperienced intern ended up soft-boiling those eggs instead, and so when he cut open the muffin, the egg was soft-boiled and the yolk oozed out of it. And at first he got angry, and then he thought, wait, people love it when things ooze out of other things.
Yeah.
And this Instagram sensation was born, called The Rebel Within, and it is really delicious, as we learned on our visit to the bakery. So is it a mistake? I think in some cases it's all a matter of perspective.
We didn't want these pierogies, I'll tell you that much. I wanted to get into another idea you suggest, keeping a creativity journal. That sounds like a lot of fun.
You know, it's great because when you notice things and you're looking to inspire yourself, it's really important to keep track of the ideas you have. The ideas you have are really the most important thing that you can possibly pay attention to. And I think as you review your kitchen creativity journal, you will notice as you write down your thoughts, your feelings, your daydreams, you know, cut photos from magazines, anything that grabs your attention, you put them in the journal. And over time, as you review the journal, you'll notice about the kind of things that you're paying attention to. And as you'll see patterns in them, that will help to show you the kinds of things that you're most interested in. So once you use that time, take the stillness that many of the world's most creative chefs take through taking a time to meditate or to do yoga or to do long distance running or cycling, to really process your life and process your influences. And that is exactly where the next great creative idea will come from.
We just have a few moments left, Karen. Give people a first step. If they're buying into this, they want to get creative, what's something they can do this weekend?
I think it's all about doing what you love. You know, thinking about what is it that's important to you, coming up with an inspiration, and that could be an ingredient, that could be a technique that you've always wanted to try. You've been hearing about spiralizing, you go and you buy a spiralizer, or someone gives you a bottle of wine and you're thinking, what can I make to best enhance this bottle of wine? That can be a great starting point for you to start free associating about that ingredient or that technique or that bottle of wine, and to come up with something that is going to please you and, most importantly, please your guests, because especially this time of year, that's what it's all about.
In just a couple of words, Karen, what are you experimenting with nowadays?
It's always about the next great thing. So I think at this time of the holidays, already starting to think, and my husband's birthday is a week before Christmas, so it's thinking about what can I do that's going to really excite him and please him this time of year. And so it's about getting inside his head as opposed to being inside my head and what is going to make it special for him. But if I say any more, it'll ruin the surprise.
Fantastic. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Karen Page. She's author of the book Kitchen Creativity, Unlocking Culinary Genius with Wisdom, Inspiration, and Ideas from the World's Most Creative Chefs. The Carol Burnett Show was a classic of American comedy, and this weekend we can catch up with Carol on a 50th anniversary special on the TV. Michelle Good was a Carol Burnett fan, and I watched the show as a kid growing up, too. Hello, Michelle. I mean, I say hello. You've been sitting there the whole time.
I've been sitting here staring at you the whole time.
And when I think about it, Carol Burnett, she's right up your alley. Very talented.
Yes. I love the skits that she did. I mean, some of the best humor that influenced me, I went to improv school. I don't know if you know that, but Carol Burnett was a huge inspiration to me. I mean, who doesn't remember her Gone with the Wind skit when she's walking down with that? But there were so many others. She could sing. She could do solo monologues. She was a great ensemble player. She really had it all.
Yeah, and we were just talking about Tracy Ullman before the show. Yeah. I don't remember why, but she's somebody like inspired by clearly and in the vein of Carol Burnett. So she's somebody who's had an inspiration for a lot of other people down through the years.
She certainly has. I'm sure if you ask Tracy Ullman, Carol Burnett's probably on her list, too.
And, of course, everybody loved on the Carol Burnett Show when they'd crack each other up so much. I mean, I know in improv and real comedy, you're not supposed to break, but they broke, and it was hilarious, and I loved it.
It was some of the best parts.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.